just full of rats and cockroaches.
Nobody's gonna send me to jail, and you know it.
Why don't you tell Tom that back there you really believe? You're stuck. No car, no purse. One wrong word out of you, you end up in jail.
One wrong word like the one you sent Jerry?
Jerry's an old friend. A man can't let his friends down, can he?
Stop it.
Hell, get in there. I ain't gonna hurt you. I just want company. Have you back here in time for the 10:40 bus to Oklahoma City? Buy your ticket myself.
No!
You yell, I'll bust you. Then you city folks gotta learn talk's cheap, but it takes money to buy with. Get in there. You and me's going to a stall today.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be necessary. Possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, author of a good many things, including, most recently, what's your most recent work? You've redone Forgotten Horrors 4, I know.
Yes, that has been a long time coming. That was the most problematical book of the whole series.
First one we collaborated on, too. Is that a coincidence?
That was the first one we did any authentic deep set collaborating on. But yeah, I had a troubled publishing history with a couple of, the less said about whom, the better.
Yes, indeed.
And so, you know, once you get things where you can take the buck stops here, in other words.
Right.
And then you can get around those applications of somebody else's. I don't mind my bad taste because it's mine. But other people's bad taste, like, right. Keep it to yourself.
That's right. That's exactly right. But that's out now on Amazon.com. And you just have to punch in Michael H. Price, and you'll find a whole raft of interesting material. And while you're at it, take a look at... We'll go ahead and front-load the plugs this time. While you're at it, take a look at The Twilight Avenger, the new graphic novel that...
What a beauty.
Oh, thank you. The Pulp 2.0 Press just put out. I've got... I'm really pleased with the essay that I did on that about... because to me, the fall of Elite Comics of Midland, Texas is sort of emblematic of what happened to the black and white comics boom back in the 1980s.
Splendid series coincided roughly with The Prowler that I worked on.
It sure did. That's right, for Eclipse.
I think we teamed those guys up in one page.
We did. We did a pinup. We teamed them up in a pinup page that you did,
which
which will probably be seeing the light of day at some point, because things have been so encouraging with those Bill at Pulp 2.0 Press. The MPB, as we like to call him, Bill Cunningham, the mad pulp bastard, he has expressed an interest in continuing both the Miracle Squad and the Twilight Avenger series as graphic novels. We've had some very good feedback on it. So, now, with that said, let's go ahead. The next two films, actually, Michael, that we're going to be talking about, as you know, are both films that were shot in Oklahoma, and Joey... our producer, Joey Hambrick, said to me when we were emailing back and forth about this after I talked to you about doing Rumblefish, which will be our next one, that you take these two films together and you pretty much encompass the Oklahoma filmmaking experience. And I think in a lot of ways that's really true. This film that we're talking about, which is called Stark Fear, it can be found... from Something Weird on one of their multi-film packages. You can find it a lot of different places. It was initially released by Ellis which was essentially an art film house that imported some films, but the filmmakers never saw a dime from Ellis, and of course their grandiose plans of making more films fell by the wayside.
Just like Herc Harvey and Carnival of Souls.
Just like it in Texas. That was the Texas analog, and that's exactly right. And both of these films, I think, people tend to give short shrift to Stark Fear, and I really don't know why. I've watched it several times now, and I really think it's got a lot going for it. What are your general impressions of the picture?
I loved it when it was new, and I have continued to revisit Stark Fear. When it was a new picture, I was just still, you know, in like thriller withdrawal from network television.
Of course, yes.
That is, Thriller being no relation to Michael Jackson, but rather the series of film noir and horror stories that appeared on network television.
With Boris Karloff. Yeah, Boris Karloff was the...
Karloff as the host and frequent player. When I saw Stark Fear, I said, my gosh, this is like a lost episode of Thriller.
How interesting. I never thought of it that way.
Splendid little picture, and I do mean little. It makes no pretensions.
That's right.
Dealing in the practice that the legal and psychiatric rackets used to term mental cruelty.
Yes, exactly. And
a little bit of gas, kind of a backwater gaslight in many ways.
In many ways it is, and also very influenced, of course, by Psycho.
And by Psycho.
You know, it was like a little bit like the erotic thrillers of the 80s. And before that, the slasher pictures.
The Germanic idiom called Krimi, K-R-I-M-I.
Yes, yes.
The Edgar Wallace stories, mm-hmm. Not per se, but the Edgar Wallace stories that got adapted in Germany.
Right.
And were comparatively, like, and here again is that black and white film noir vibe that you get channeled through a foreign sensibility. I should think Oklahoma might even qualify as a foreign sensibility to Hollywood.
Yes, and Texas as well, of course.
Definitely. The regional provinces generate some of the most interesting films because they're not trying to... Well, some of them may be trying to imitate the Hollywood establishment, but even if they were trying, they couldn't because they are who they are.
That's right, and they're putting their own spin on it. And, you know, we talk about the slasher films, and I had somebody describe the template for slasher films to me, which was 8 kids go into the woods, 6 die. That's pretty much it. The same with the erotic thrillers. It didn't take much money or much makeup. Maybe some, you know, special effects as far as the carnage went, but that was about it. They're very cheap to make, and I don't think that needs to be that should be overlooked. I mean,
not a debit. Yeah. I mean, you look at what Coppola achieved with Rumblefish on a tiny budget.
That's exactly right. And
Stark Fear, yeah, it's like, okay, Stark Fear, what is this? It's probably more a neurotic thriller than an erotic thriller.
That's right. Although there are some erotic and very sick kind of parts in it, too.
Very, very much so. This is a film that I think Larry Buchanan was an admirer of Stark Fear.
Really? I wouldn't be a
bit
surprised.
It would make sense, of course.
Sure would, yeah.
Texas provincial filmmaker keeping tabs on what would have been his more direct competition. And, you know, probably the best erotic thrillers of that period, the early 60s, were made by Hammer Films in England.
Yes, yes.
And probably the high point being Cash on Demand with
mm-hmm.
Peter Cushing,
mm-hmm.
and maybe Candy from a Stranger,
mm-hmm.
which is still unnerving.
Mm-hmm.
From my long-term and more recent viewings, I think Stark Fear belongs in that company.
Well, I think it does, too, and a lot of people have dismissed it as a Psycho knockoff, and there are some things that are similar. There's the mother obsession, of course, that plays a big part in Stark Fear. It's black and white. It's got a real undercurrent of kind of a sort of diseased, I guess, sexuality. I know they were originally going to call it at one point, the shooting title was going to be Black Lace, which, of course, refers to the bra that Beverly Garland buys to apparently sort of entice her husband, played by Skip Holmeyer. Am I saying his name right? Skippy
Skip
Holmeyer?
Holmeyer, yes.
And Kenneth Toby is the third person. This is playing an oil man. And
yeah, we're talking about major league genre stars from the film capital.
That's exactly right. And also people who were not major league stars, but
right.
would be recognizable. I mean, Kenneth Toby did The Thing, for gosh sake. He wasn't that far removed from Whirly Birds, the TV series, nor was Beverly Garland that far removed from Decoy, her TV series, where she played a policewoman, or the Corman pictures that she'd been doing, see? And so she had a built-in, so it was that deal where it's a local, provincial, as you say, filmmaking group. The group was called BHS, which stood for Joe E. Burke, who was an ad man in Oklahoma City, Ned Hockman, and Dwight Swain, an old pulp writer, who was also working at that time in the, they didn't have a film department then at OU, I think it was, audio visual or something, and so was Ned Hockman. And the three of them, and they'd done some industrial films together, and out of this, they looked at Psycho, and they said, look, you can shoot this in black and white, you don't need a lot of big splashy effects or pyrotechnics, you can do a small film and make some money, and I believe that's really the reason that they got into it. And I'll tell you, Michael, one of the things that I noticed when Joey and I watched it here a couple of weeks ago in preparation to do this podcast, I think one of the things you and I both probably respond to is how well they nail the oil business.
Boy.
Isn't that the truth?
Well, it takes one to know one.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And they've got those guys. Kenneth Toby is like all the hard drinking, or they're drinking martinis at noon and eating steaks, and they're just all, you know, they're all these, you know, drilling dry holes, and they're all gamblers, and they, the reviews I've seen of the film, I don't recall seeing a review that ever mentioned that.
The film nails the Southwestern. Ranching oil scene.
Yes.
One transitions into the other at a certain point in history, much more accurately than, shall we say, Giant.
Mm-hmm. Or Oklahoma Crude, for that matter.
Oh, yeah. Or Oklahoma Crude,
yeah.
or Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really do like a cosmopolitan attitude in filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
But when you can get a good little scrappy provincial company with the gumption to try to compete with the big guys, that you get a film like this, that is so much more accurate because these guys know their territory.
Yes, they do know their territory. They know their milieu. And this is almost all shot. It's a little bit. It was shot in Arkansas, but most of this was shot in Oklahoma City and surrounding areas. I've not been able to nail down the town in which Beverly Garland has, I mean, you know, she, it's like Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe going to Bay City. You just know when he goes to Bay City, bad things are going to happen. And when the character goes to Quanah, Beverly Garland's character goes to Quanah, horrible things happen. And I know Quanah and that little crazy little museum, that Juke Museum, that gives part of the really the creepiest scenes just about of all the film are in that Juke Museum, which is a kind of a, they have jukeboxes and player pianos, and it's just and she gets in there and it's just such a weird setting, and I know that's some little place in some little Oklahoma town somewhere, but I've not been able to find it. There's almost an Okie David Lynch quality to some of this stuff.
Man, oh man.
Don't you think?
Well, I think David Lynch would be proud and ready to acknowledge such a vibe.
I think you're right, yeah. What about the performances? How do you feel about the performances in the picture?
Beverly Garland told me she didn't enjoy the experience. Apparently there were some tensions among the production crew, the the underwriters and the filmmakers.
Particularly the director, I think, particularly Ned Hawkman, I understand.
Ned Hawkman, who apparently just, he had a vision. It clashed with the underwriters. This is, you know, not as though I were there to report on it, but from Beverly Garland's account, they were having some creative disagreements, which is not uncommon in large or small filmmaking.
Right.
And that the actor Skip Hohmeyer, playing her bad husband, turned good guy and finished directing the picture. If that is indeed the case, then the transition looks pretty seamless to me.
It does to me, too. And I have heard the same thing, that Ned Hawkman walked off the picture at one point and left them to do it. That was the only picture he ever directed. I mean, he directed a lot of industrial films and, you know, educational films for OU, but he never, that was the only feature film he did. However, I will say, when Beverly Garland came back for its theatrical, they were doing some sort of a screening down at OU, and Beverly Garland, ever gracious, as you know, you and I have both visited with her.
Wonderful
lady.
What a
sweetheart she was. Said, you know, didn't we have a wonderful time making that film? And she didn't get into any of the negativity at all.
But Beverly Garland will go on the record if you are speaking to her from a scholarly vantage.
Yes.
But she will not gossip.
Yes. Yes.
And gosh, what a classy thing not to do, and whatever happened to that.
She's
terrific. She plays very well off Skip Hohmeyer.
Mm-hmm. And Kenneth Toby, I think.
And
too.
Kenneth Toby.
Yeah.
You gotta say this is a strong woman character, which is rare today, rarer in those days. Might be subjected to some guff from some no good worthless men, but this is no Lifetime Channel nonsense.
No,
this is a real gritty piece of work. In many ways, what our old buddy Clive Barker would refer to as a film that means to do you harm.
Exact. Good point. That's a very good point. Yeah. And it does, too, because watching the scene in the graveyard, which I won't spoil it for anyone who's not seen it, is still an extremely creepy experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody had their hand on something really palpable and not the kind of stuff you want to touch too often. But when you do, better make sure you've got a safe distance of a movie screen between you.
That's right. And when they can, and it's a little unsettling when they conflate it with the stomp dance, the Comanche stomp dance that they have,
which is another big
Oklahoma thing. We have a lot of stomp dances in this part of the country, and to conflate it, and somehow I had a little trouble with that, because the stomp dance was somehow not just weird to Occidental eyes or, you know, European eyes, European descent eyes, but also somehow menacing. And the stomp dances that I know about are not really menacing. They're very they're an expression, you know, of the American Indian you know, way of life, but this is conflated. These two things are conflated in this picture, the stomp dances and the horrible thing that happens to Beverly Garland.
Yeah, well, perception is the flip side of reality.
and she does bounce back. But yeah, I know the Harvey, whatever that goofy Harvey Suggs or Harvey Suggets, says, get in there. You and me is going to a stomp dance. And it's very, it's almost got the Herschel Gordon Lewis hillbilly fear thing going for it, you know, that he had in 2000 Maniacs, especially. Also, I think that it's very, the whole milieu again of the oil field is something that maybe if you're not from around our part of the country, it's a little hard to understand. But I guess they're not really. It's not just to call them entrepreneurs is not enough, Michael. I don't know what you would say, what you would call them.
The oil industry is the closest thing the 19th and 20th centuries had seen to ocean piracy.
Oh, tell me more.
Drove out the agrarian culture.
Yes, and the native culture.
Native cultures, mm-hmm. Of course, the cavalry and the settlers had pretty well gotten a handle on that. The Comanche is often painted as the bad guy, but I think there was more indignation than depredation mm-hmm. going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Robert E. Howard over at Cross Plains, Texas, grew up during that period and saw the farm culture basically trampled under and demolished by this new breed of transient thug industry,
mm-hmm.
and basically created the character of Conan the Barbarian as a caricature of this new breed of settler.
I had no idea that's where Conan came from.
That's something that I had determined reading Howard's correspondence years ago. I had my grandfather's cousin was Hoffman Price, of course.
Yes.
And he was first. He became Howard's first biographer by default.
Yes.
And I used to read a lot of Howard correspondence through the courtesy of that family connection, and he was not eternally, but frequently complaining about how the oil the roughnecks and their corporate bosses much more so than the railroads had driven the cattle and our agriculture business into a very bad corner from which even to this day it has never recovered and probably won't.
Right.
That's why we had corporate farming take over mom and pop farming. That's what caused the Great Dust Bowl, bad corporate farming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Irresponsible stewardship of the soil. And like I say, don't get me started.
You know? Yeah, we're starting to get into Woody Guthrie territory now.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And of course, you can't talk about Oklahoma without talking about Woody Guthrie.
No,
you certainly can't.
You certainly can't. And you even have that feeling over this. And, you know, Beverly Garland does such a wonderful job in that she just keeps coming back. She's like, I was thinking the other day, in some ways, and I don't mean to be fatuous with this comparison, but in some ways she reminds me of Ma Jode and the whole We're the People thing, we're the people that live, you know, we go on.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
She keeps going on under these horrible, she is, Skip Holmeyer is just an absolute psychological mess. And you know, and his buddy Harvey is just a redneck idiot. But there's a party scene. Do you recall the party scene in Stark Fair where
all of
these guys are making passes, or the guy's making a pass at Beverly Garland, and she's such a survivor, and she is the viewpoint character, and I think that's pretty unusual too in a film.
That is very unusual, and of course the. What's the overriding quality of Texas, Oklahoma? Probably, I would say the entire Southwest, but I've noticed it mostly in family of mine in Texas and Oklahoma.
Yes.
What's the operative word? Gumption.
Gumption. She has a lot of gumption. And she has enough gumption to stay by a guy, Skippy Holmeyer, who is just... Absolutely, we'd have cut him loose. If I'd have been a woman, I'd have cut him loose a long time ago. And and then there's good old Kenneth Toby, who's kind of Cliff Kane. What a great name that is.
Mm-hmm,
Cliff
mm-hmm.
Kane, the oil man. And the whole thing is just, I think it's been given short shrift by when people deign to review it. They just don't seem to see it. They don't seem to see anything in the picture beyond just, well, here's a psycho knockoff.
No, I'm really surprised the Medved brothers haven't put it on their hit list.
Oh, for God's sake. Now, don't get me started on that.
<Don't get there.
laughs> Oh, Lord, no.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, this film looks like it was made on about a $1.98
right.
budget.
That's right.
It's like, oh, for the love of.
Never
mind.
Well, we've been pretty good about, well, we've been very good and very diligent about not being snarky, because we saw when, you know, and let's face it, the 50 worst films of all time and the Golden Turkey Awards did do something to draw people to our kinds of films and to these kinds of films, but it's like a gateway drug. I mean, you want to, you know, you kind of want to drop, you know, drop away from that and get into something a little bit, with a little bit more substance, a little bit less snark. It takes an enormous amount of people working very hard to make a bad film.
Oh yeah, yeah. Really, unless you're Troma Corp, nobody really tries to make a bad
right.
film.
Right, and most, you know, we go with the Susan Sontag thing about intentional camp is always worse than unintentional camp.
Yeah, and
even this film is not even camp. This film is just a pretty good psychological study with some excellent acting. And I do mean, I did before we left it, I did want to mention. Hannah Stone, who plays Ruth, who's kind of...
oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah, she's wonderful. Yeah. She shows up in some other Oklahoma films. And George Clough, who plays Harvey Suggetts, they're both theater veterans from Oklahoma City. Now, of course, what they did, what a lot of people do in these sorts of situations is that the film company BHS brought in three leads from Hollywood, mid-range actors, probably got them fairly inexpensively,
and
then filled the rest of the cast with Oklahoma actors, most of them taken from the Oklahoma stage. But those two, Hannah Stone and George Clough, really have very pivotal parts in it, and I think they both acquit themselves very well.
They try. The provincial stage players try a lot harder than a lot of commercial actors.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And that's of course why Larry Buchanan had such good actors who weren't big names in his picture, because he resorted to the stage community.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, if it's probably the best performance in Peter Bogdanovich's last picture show, speaking of regional films,
yes,
belongs to Bill Thurman as the really bad coach.
Who went on to have a nice career, didn't he?
Yeah, a nice career, but how did Bogdanovich discover Bill Thurman? Well, it sure as heck wasn't watching TV commercials in Texas where he, or going to the little theater. It was watching Larry Buchanan's movies.
Oh, it was? I didn't know that.
That was what Bogdanovich told me. I think it was on the Texasville press tour that he found Billy Thurman hiding in plain sight in I believe it was It's Alive.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Nick Millard, who did the Crazy Fat Ethel films, said the very same thing. He says he didn't want to pay SAG actors, of course. Of course not. But the other thing is he drew his people from the little theater in San Francisco. He said
they're diligent.
They're happy to be working. It's like Christopher Lewis telling me one time, of course, who directed Blood Cult and later on my film, Dan Turner, Hollywood Detective, the one I wrote.
Right.
Chris was the son of Loretta Young. And Chris said, you know, he said in Hollywood, you walk up to somebody's door and you knock and you say, I'm with a film company. They know immediately how much they want to charge you to come in and shoot in their house. He says, in Tulsa, you knock on somebody's door and say, with a film company, say, come on in, what can we do for you? And they're at your disposal.
Yeah.
You know, we have, and it's the same thing with little theater. There's that thing about, we're just happy to be here, we're happy to help, we're happy to be in a movie.
Nice.
And that's kind of, this infuses, this film has a very much of a homemade quality. I mean, they had big ideas. They had two or three scripts ready to go. Dwight Swain told me that he had a second script ready to go, but Ellis Films, they never saw a dime out of it. And so much is killed, as you well know, and your friend Larry Buchanan knows, and Dave Friedman knows, so much of it was killed in distribution. Making a film is easy. Distributing a film and getting the money for it is difficult, I think.
And the hard part should be the creativity, and the easy part should be getting it out and collecting.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
You would think so. Yeah, well, that's why we've gone through so many goofy adventures in getting some of these books of ours
published. That's exactly right. Now, we're going
No,
to...
No,
yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, it's a breeze making. I have never worked on a tedious book.
Right.
Some more, some less enjoyable than others, but I've never been in the middle of writing a book or making a studio recording that felt like drudgery.
Right.
Therefore, if that's the hard part, then the distribution ought to be the really easy part.
Well, you'd certainly think so, wouldn't you?
So it goes. Anyway, yeah.
Well, now, next time we get together, we're going to talk, we're going to kind of break our format such as it is, but in a way we're not breaking it, because we're going to be talking about the film Rumblefish, which was a big-budget film, but it didn't do very well. And it was the film that Coppola did after The Outsiders. He did it in Tulsa, shot it in Tulsa. The Outsiders, of course, was a runaway success. And Rumblefish, which he made right after that, was not. But I think it's a great picture. And
superior picture. It is a pointer toward many other pictures that challenge the status quo. It deals in crime, which I equate with horror films.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like as if we needed to justify what we...
Right.
I mean, these decisions, if it looks interesting, grab it. The unnerving qualities of Rumblefish, although it is a very tasteful and generally enjoyable film, did in fact kind of pave the way for the more disturbing excesses of, say, Larry Clark.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, yeah.
But we'll get into that, and gosh, you know.
We will, and meanwhile, we just want to thank everybody for listening to the broadcast and for voting for us in the Rondo Awards. We were a nominee in the Rondo Awards, and we want to thank those of you who voted for us, and we want to thank those of you who listened to us and voted for somebody else. We're just happy to have you listening. And we will be back. Meanwhile, take a look at the Michael Price and John Woolley books on the internet and on Amazon.com. And we would appreciate your support. But even if we don't have your support with the books, we're glad to have you listening.
So glad.
Thank you, Michael. We'll be talking to you soon.
Back with you soon now.
All right.